The time is 8 p.m. Eastern. You're listening to Live with the Infidel Guy. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Live with the Infidel Guy. I really appreciate it. Wherever you are, make sure you join us at the website at infidelguy.com. Check us out in the chat room. That's where we all are. If you have any questions for me or my guest, you can try to relay those to us. Type them in red, and we'll try to address your comments or questions. Also, you can call in toll-free, and I'll let you know when. Write this number down, 888-503-0802. We have a very interesting program, I think, for you tonight. We're going to talk about the concept of immortality. Now, we have with us on the line, once again, we have Keith Augustine on the program. And if you remember, he was on prior, celebrating the 10th anniversary of Internet Infidels. So you can check out that website at infidels.org. He's reappearing to talk about something that he's done quite a bit of reading and research on, the concept of immortality. And we're going to talk about his interest in the topic, the case against life after death, the history of disbelief in an afterlife, whether we can come to terms with the inevitability of ceasing to exist forever, and whether those who disbelieve in life after death are more malicious than afterlife believers. Welcome to the program once again, Keith Augustine.
Hi, thanks. It's good to be back.
Yeah, well, Keith, I guess we should probably start off first with defining exactly what immortality is. There's so many different definitions, and now there's life extension technology coming up and all these various things. Well, what do we mean when we talk about, or what do you mean when we talk about immortality, or when we think about immortality?
Yeah, actually, the term immortality was specifically chosen because philosophers tend to use that term. You see a different term used in, say, the parapsychological literature, which would be something like the survival problem or survival question. Immortality is, in a sense, an unfortunate term because you could, for example, believe in bodily immortality. Like you said, you know, life extension where you just don't die bodily. And
right.
That's not generally what we have in mind or what I have in mind when I talk about immortality. Basically, I mean living forever, assuming some other kind of existence than the one in your current body. So basically there are really two issues there even. You know, does something survive death would be the first question, would be the sort of survival question. And then,
okay.
You know, there's really a tag on there when you use the term immortality, which would be, does it survive forever? So you could theoretically answer something survives death, but, you know, after 20 years it dissipates or something like that, or it keeps on going forever. But, you know, historically, they've sort of been tied together in religious thought anyway. You know, the whole purpose of surviving is to keep on surviving, right?
Yeah, and some think, I know, I mean, I've talked about this myself as well, maybe a couple of years ago, and my thought was, well, I guess it's kind of like the whole concept probably is like maybe there's some evolutionary mechanism behind it all. I don't know. It seems like it's like a survival mechanism almost. It's like this part of you that can think abstractly, and we have these imaginations kind of said, hey, you know, because you want to persist after you die, I mean, or you just want to continue to live, I should say. So yeah, you know, when you die, something else must be out there. I mean, because this can't be it. My being just won't allow it. I mean, what do you think?
Right, that's exactly the sort of motivation for, I think, denying that, you know, this is just it. Most people, you know, don't mind thinking about that in the abstract too much, but when you apply it to yourself, it's like, oh no, that couldn't possibly be true about me, right?
Right.
The ego wants to keep going on. As for like sort of the evolutionary, I wouldn't try to directly associate the idea of immortality with, you know, specifically being something directly the result of evolution. It's probably evolution sort of shaped our minds in certain ways, and that the immortality belief sort of arise culturally in some ways to sort of meet those biological needs, because there are some cultures that actually don't have the idea of immortality, so it would be sort of presumptuous to think that there's sort of like this biological need for us to believe in life after death.
Interesting. Yeah, and who knows how they handle that, I guess. I guess that's some of the stuff we're going to talk about today. Is like,
yeah.
How do people even deal with that concept? I've always said this. I want to see if you maybe agree with me a little bit on this. But for some people, it isn't true. But what I want to say is I don't necessarily fear death itself. What I really fear is how I die. The method in which I die, was it long, and am I going to be tortured before I die,
right.
and things like this. And some people will just, no, I'm just afraid of the concept, period. But I think it was, I might be wrong here, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Epicurus who once said, why should I fear something that doesn't exist when I do?
Right, right.
There's something of that nature.
Actually, there, you know, people talk about the fear of death, and the people who sort of study this thing, Thanatologists, they usually almost always will talk about different fears of death, right? And one of them is actually what you would call the fear of dying. You know, how is it going to be right before I sort of go out of existence? You know, is it going to be painful or not? Is it going to be quick? Am I even going to notice it? That's one sort of thing that's often called the fear of death. The sort of thing that I've become more recently interested in is the fear of death itself, the state of not existing, which is exactly what you bring up when you mention Epicurus. Epicurus did basically say, you know, why should you fear even the prospect of ceasing to exist when, if you're not there to exist, you can't experience any harm?
Right, right. Exactly.
And I think he caught on to something there. I think there's a grain of truth in a lot of the different responses, but at the same time, I don't think it really goes as far as he would like it to.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that a lot of people, you'll see like one of Epicurus' main followers, Lucretius, for example,
yeah.
will give all these examples of here's why you shouldn't worry about death. He has this long poem in Book 3 of On the Nature of Things.
Okay.
And he'll say something like, you know, the birds will be picking at your bones, or they'll throw your body on the funeral pyre, and you know, but you won't feel the flames or the picking. It's sort of like everyone knows that. Everyone knows that whatever happens to your body isn't going to happen to you. And even if you think that the mind has stopped at that point,
mm-hmm.
you know, you sort of know that. I think most people know that when they fear death, or when they fear the idea of not existing. What they fear mm-hmm. is that sort of not being there.
Mm-hmm.
And the permanence of it even is even more important. If you like put someone into suspended animation for like 300 years, well, that's not too bad. It's like taking a nap and then waking up a really long time later.
Although technically,
taking a nap and never waking up, that scares the hell out of people.
Exactly. That's a good point, because although technically you really kind of are dead for all of
Well, it's like eight hours a day or whatever. You're unconscious for a long period of time.
Right, right.
Even though you have dreams, you know, for a good period of time, you're unconscious. You're not dreaming the whole time that you're out. It's the idea that the unconsciousness will never be broken. It's just like once it starts, that's it forever. I think that's what really scares people.
Hmm. Kind of reminds me of, I had someone on the program prior talking about, I guess this kind of obviously just ties into the soul, because that's primarily what people think persists when you die, is the soul.
Right, most people think of the
right,
soul.
So we're thinking about, well, what if you can put everything that is you into a computer chip? So are you alive, dead, immortal? It gets kind of confusing at that point for some people, if that could ever be possible.
Yeah, philosophers come up with all kinds of weird counterexamples to things like that. One example is like, imagine a spore that never gets destroyed. You know, spores are pretty tough thing, but you know, it never becomes a plant or something like a plant. Right?
Mm.
It just exists as a spore for all eternity. That wouldn't quite be. You know, if you can imagine that, what's really important is that consciousness persists.
Mm.
So if you're unconscious forever, you know, it wouldn't even really matter if it, like, your brain could be kept alive artificially. But if you know, if you were basically brain dead, other than the brainstem. Right, that would be the equivalent of death.
Hmm. It's mold spores. Just reminds me, we're having a big attack by those right now. But now, of course, the primary argument I get all the time about the whole idea of life after death is that, well, so many people believe it. Of course, we know the "so many people believe it" argument isn't really true. But what arguments do we have that? I guess, again, it still kind of really ties into the soul. I mean, that the soul does not exist, or that there is an afterlife. What arguments do we have against this claim?
Well, let me address the first question first.
Yeah.
Mark Twain actually said something quite relevant to that first argument, which was so many myriads believe in the immortality of the soul, and they can't be wrong, was the sort of argument he'll give, and this is a paraphrase, he would say, and they also believe that the earth was flat, right?
Right, so, right, right.
Obviously, the number of people who believe something has nothing to do with what the truth of the matter is.
Mm-hmm.
I
get that all the time.
Arguments like that
yeah.
in favor of immortality. But I'd say the strongest argument that there isn't any sort of life after death, especially in terms of the idea of a soul, there are a couple of other concepts that you could try to bring into it to sort of save it, but is this idea of mind-brain dependence, or the dependence of consciousness on the brain. And
okay.
basically, you know, there's a lot of evidence that the mind sort of cannot exist without the brain. It doesn't. You can localize specific mental functions to specific areas of the brain. You destroy this area of the brain, and there that mental function goes away. You look at how animals think. And, you know, the sort of complexity of an animal's thought depends on how big its brain is. A couple mm-hmm. other things. You know, the same thing developmentally in infants up to adulthood. You know, how far you develop sort of as you grow older determines how far your mind sort of develops. And, you know, if something stops, you know, that's how far your mind will go when your brain stops developing at a certain point.
Mm.
So there are all these sorts of evidences that mentality
that is interesting.
Extremely dependent on what your brain is doing. I mean, you can just take out someone's frontal lobe and they'll lose all their inhibitions. That's actually what happened to Phineas Gage. A tamping iron went through his brain. He was tapping something for a railroad, and he was tapping some gunpowder, and it exploded prematurely and went right through his brain, and he actually lived through it. And people talked about, you know, how he was so different. He wasn't the same person afterward.
Right, right.
He used to be responsible, and, like, he would never show up at work, and they would curse all the time. And, like, you can change a person's character. So, you know, it's also raises all kinds of interesting questions for Christian ideas, specifically, like salvation.
Right.
If you have free will and your salvation depends on how you behave, well, how you behave largely depends on how your brain's working. So.
True. I've often extended that argument a little bit to state that how can you be responsible? Well, for instance, we know that when the brain goes through trauma, people lose memories. Their personality changes, as you were mentioning, stuff like that. Now, let's say this person's a Christian and he dies, but now your brain dies. So now you have, for lack of a better term, quote, awakened in this new realm where you're to be judged by God for everything you did. My first thought was, hey, God, I don't even remember what I did.
Right. It wasn't me, right?
Right, right. I don't know who that guy was, but...
Yeah, now that my soul is free from the shackles of the material world, I never would have thought like that.
Exactly.
So it's not my fault. You're the one who put me in this body and brain.
Right, right. That's a good one. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, actually, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me because, you know, we define who we are in terms of things like our personality and character and our memories and what we know, and you strip that away from somebody and
right.
you're no longer yourself. You're no longer
exactly.
the individual you've become.
Exactly.
Like, who's appearing on the afterlife? Did you die and someone else appear?
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, right, right.
you get the sort of the same problem with reincarnation because, you know, basically you start over as a blank slate, and the whole point of reincarnation is for you to learn, but
okay.
if you don't remember anything, how can you learn, you know?
That's so interesting. Yeah, I once heard the same. Well, I don't know if this is true. I'm not much up on my reincarnation and those religions that accept that. But I once heard that in some beliefs, I think it might be Hinduism, that I think some sects of Hinduism, that if you do something bad, like this karma thing, like when you die, you come back as some lesser animal or something, like a cockroach if you're really, you know, I've heard. And some say you reincarnate as other people, but I've also heard that, you know, you reincarnate as certain animals if you were really bad.
Yeah, that's definitely a Hindu belief.
Okay.
Specifics of, I'm sure there's some sort of specifics you have to do a certain amount wrong before you get to this level.
Right, right. See, I thought the same thing then. Okay, so I'm going to be a cockroach. Okay, I have no higher brain function whatsoever. I have no idea why I'm punished. You know, it's just, okay, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, karma just can't be working properly.
Once you go from a human being to a cockroach, it's hard to see how you can say that one person went from one thing to the other.
Ah, right, right.
Like that's again, you know, a human being died and a cockroach was born. You know? Like, what's the connection?
Yeah, let's go back to earlier you mentioned about the size of the brain. Obviously, our higher thinking is dependent upon the size of our brain.
Well, I was actually saying the complexity.
Okay.
Size is proportionate to body. So, like, a whale brain could be really large, but you have to look at the size of the whale body, too. So,
okay. Oh, really? Okay, understood. Gotcha. So basically, well, we know that smaller, smoother brains, typically dumb animals. But the brain with more convolutions, right? More surface area and neural connections, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah, cerebral cortex is
right.
unique I believe, unique to primates. So that gives you an example of that.
Right.
Sort of the layer on top of the rest of the brain.
Ah. And dolphins as well has this type of unique-looking, convoluted brain as well, don't they?
Dolphins, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm not really sure about the dolphin brain, so I can't, okay, can't really comment on that. I know that they're more intelligent than most mammals.
But the reason I asked that is because there was a woman I met in Pal Talk, and we were basically arguing about the differences between humans and animals, and we started talking about dreams. And so we were asking, do animals dream? And so she was beginning to say that, well, that dreams are produced by the soul, that the spirit is the reason why people can dream. And I said, what about all these animals that can dream? And she was like, well, they don't think on the same level that we think, and they can't dream on the same level we dream, because humans are special. Said, why are we so special? And she went back to this higher cognitive function thing, that human beings are special because of our spirit is special. And anyway, I said, well, there are organisms that are smarter than our three-year-olds. Now, surely we agree that our 3- and 4-year-olds can dream. So how do you explain that there are chimpanzees and dolphins that might be smarter than our 3- and 4-year-olds? They must have a soul. So I guess they're going to heaven. And she didn't like that too tough. I thought that was pretty interesting that she didn't like the idea that there are chimps that are smarter than our 3-year-olds.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
How
it's
do you...
Certain, yeah, because I think a chimpanzee's brain is something like a 4-year-old.
Right,
so obviously
right.
If you're younger than that,
right,
the chimp is going to be smarter than you for at least
for a little while.
Short period of time.
Right, right. So anyway, this is where the argument was going originally about the size of the brain, because this kind of shows, I guess, I think this is inductive logic. I'm not a philosopher necessarily. But if this is true, if it seems like the complexity of these brains and all this stuff and minds are created out of these complex brains, then it seems like if you have no brain, you have no consciousness. Kind of seems like that's where it's kind of going.
Yeah, a good example of this is Paul Edwards' quoted column again, saying basically this. Is what it comes down to is that you can say that, you know, this mental trait is associated with this area of the brain, and this other mental trait is... And basically what you end up having is what you call the mind is the collection of all these different mental traits, and you know that they're all associated with different areas of the brain, so what happens at death is all those areas of the brain are destroyed. So it doesn't really leave much room for the mind to be left over. You know, the mind is all those different collected sort of mental faculties.
Right.
You know, personality, consciousness, or some of the more complex versions of it. But for example, without memory, how much of a personality do you have if you can't remember anything?
And that's exactly what I was going to ask you, too. I get a lot of criticisms from some of my listeners who talk about how obviously important I think memory is to having a consciousness. I think it's extremely important. Some argue that someone have told me that this, I guess, is David Hume's concept that memory is basically the essential thing needed to form a consciousness. And I'm pretty much in agreement with that. I mean, what do you think? You kind of
I would say definitely that without memory, there's no sense of self-identity. I mean,
right.
If you erase someone's memory, that's basically you're sort of wiping the slate clean and starting over again.
Right.
And that's assuming that they can form new memories. So if someone gets brain damage where they can't form new memories, and there are some people who have brain damage where they can remember everything up to a certain date, and then after that they don't remember anything at all. So someone will be 40 years old and still think he's 20 and think the president is Nixon or something like that.
Right, right.
I mean, where's the soul in all that? You know,
right.
People don't think about that when they think about an afterlife. They think that they're the ones that are going to go there. But so much of who they are depends on the physical characteristics of their body, and specifically their brain.
Okay. Back to these other evidences. It kind of deviated away, but my fault. Let's go back to some of these evidences. You're talking about the complexity of these brains and other evidences that we have that the immaterial afterlife, well, or even, I don't know, can it be a physical one? I don't know. I guess
actually, there's a physical version of the afterlife.
Really? Oh, all right. There's so many.
I guess we could talk about that in a little bit. So let's see, I mentioned the developmental thing and how species are like that. Some of the other evidence, I mean, the specific brain localization I kind of mentioned in passing.
Right.
That, you know, specific areas of the brain are, so that when you combine them all, that they're all gone. But basically, you have, even in addition to that, things that are very clearly necessary for consciousness. And then we were just talking about memory, and memories are basically formed by neural networks developing.
Right.
You know, so what happens is when you learn a trait or you lose a trait, it's your, you know, especially in during the developmental, your neurons are growing a certain way. That's how you get sort of like, if you're become like very adept at music or something, it's because of the way your brain sort of wires as you're developing. So it's very clear that everything that we would call our mental life, you know, depends on sort of the functioning of all these different parts of the brain, and that it doesn't even, like, you don't even have to understand the brain in, you know, excellent detail like we do in the 20th century or the 21st century. You don't need to know all the details of neuroscience to see the general argument. I mean, people as far back as Lucretius saw the general argument, you know.
And that's something they get all the time.
If somebody is on opium, they start, you know, thinking really weird, you know, or if they're on drugs. You know, so that's another example is drugs, you know. LSD will change the way you perceive things, but it will change the what you think and what you desire and what you fear and things like that too. And so high mental functions can be altered by chemistry, or someone stimulates your brain with an electrode, you can have a memory, or, you know, even a desire. So those are the sorts of things that they don't really make much sense if the soul is just using the brain as sort of an instrument, which is the common analogy that Dulles gives, that, you know, it's like you're a driver inside a car, and then when your car crashes, the driver will be all right. That's sort of an analogy with the body dying, right?
Right.
But we know that analogy can't possibly be right. I mean, you just have to, like, completely ignore this whole body of evidence to get that. And if you take the evidence seriously, you just, you know, that analogy fails, you have to try something else.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned earlier about you don't need a neuroscientist to see the general argument. And that's pretty much a response I get from a lot of afterlife believers and soul believers and things like that, is that how can, like, scientists are still trying to discover the mysteries of the brain, they'll say.
Right.
So basically, much like with the God hypothesis to explain complexity of life and or the origins of the universe, they kind of throw God in that gap.
Yeah, the soul of the gap is what I've called that.
But what do you think? I mean, is the gap as large as they claim, or do we really know a heck of a lot more?
It can't possibly be that large.
Right.
First of all, yeah, there are always going to be gaps in our knowledge, especially the brain. The brain is basically, the human brain is the most complicated thing in the universe. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, it doesn't look this way to students, but you know, brain science is a hell of a lot more complicated than, say, physics, because what physics deals with is, like, you know, balls of gas out in space that are fusing elements together. You know?
Okay.
Comparatively, a hell of a lot simpler than what a neural network is, which is a really complicated thing. But no, I don't think the gaps in our knowledge are big enough to give them what they want, because we've already sort of established that memories depend on, you know, the certain regions of the brain all functioning together. And that basically, you know, when the brain dies, that's not going to be happening, because none of the brain is going to be functioning. So the argument is, you know, fairly straightforward.
Okay. And yeah, we have someone in the chat room with a really good question here related here. He says, what does your guest have to say about the belief that near-death experience and out-of-body experience is evidence of the soul and the afterlife?
Good person to ask that question to.
Oh, yeah?
What do I think that near-death and out-of-body experiences say about the afterlife? Or?
Well, their defenses of it, and what do you have to say about it? People who believe in those things.
Okay. I actually wrote something on this hallucinatory near-death experiences that sort of exposed that the evidence isn't nearly as good as people have been led to believe. But the first thing I would say is that a lot of the cases where you hear people talking about, you know, someone was in the operating table and they could see things down the hall are usually exaggerations. You don't see, like, real documentation of those sorts of cases. People claim them, but then they sort of fall apart under scrutiny. There was a good example of this in something called Maria's Near-Death Experience, waiting for the other shoe to drop in Skeptical Inquirer a couple years ago, probably more than 5 years ago, where there were all these claims made about this woman named Maria. They didn't even know her in that last name, and supposedly she saw the shoe on a ledge, which she couldn't have seen from her room, and they actually went to the hospital where this supposedly happened. And you could see the shoe clearly from the street, so anyone walking in could tell you about it, and you could even see it from the room.
Interesting.
You can see the ledges and things like that. For one, I would say that most of the cases that where people say they see things they couldn't possibly have seen have been exaggerated. And of course, you know, the senses of hearing and touch, there's still going to be some residual sense if you're dying. You're not dead yet.
Right.
You know, hearing is supposedly the last sense to go, too. So you're probably picking up a lot of information unconsciously, not even realize you're picking it up, or subconsciously.
That's interesting to note. My mother had an experience once where she was in a hospital, and she said she remembers hearing all the... Now, she was supposed to be under, but she says she remembers all the instruments, what they were saying, and she could see the light overhead, blah, blah, blah. And just a little bit of critical thought, I asked her, because she said she talked to the doctors about it, and they said, well, that's impossible. When you're under, you can't experience anything external. So I asked her, I said, well, is it possible then that maybe as you were coming out of the sleep, or coming out of the effects of the anesthesia, that maybe that's what you were hearing? Or maybe you fell asleep? Because I think that happens too. And it happened to me when I went through surgery. I kind of came out of the effects of the anesthesia, but then I fell asleep. And then I woke up. So,
well, you think about how alcohol affects people. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Different people have different tolerances and stuff like that. So there's probably some truth to
Of course.
How much is anesthetics is going to work on certain people, knock them out cold. Other people, it's going to work a little bit.
Right.
And, of course, you don't know how much the doses were given or what was recommended. People often find later that some doses are better.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, or different drugs do a more effective job. So, I wouldn't say that, you know, I would never use the word impossible in a situation for that. In fact, we know that, I don't know if it's one third, but a good percentage of people actually have been awake during surgery and things like that, which is really a horrifying experience.
Oh my God.
They're like paralyzed and they're, you know, and you see yourself and probably feel yourself being operated on.
But your body
can't
move. If
you're sort of under anesthetized.
Right.
So,
this kind of reminds me.
It has happened before, so it's not impossible.
Yeah, this reminds me of body paralysis and stuff when people say that they are, you know, either aliens or the devil sees them and their souls were trapped.
Sleep paralysis.
Yeah, and they can't move or something.
Yeah, that's just sort of like a natural biological mechanism. Actually, sleepwalking is when that doesn't work, when you're dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes people wake up and their brain is sort of like not completely clicked over and
right. They're
paralyzed, but they're still dreaming and seeing things, and that's what becomes frightening.
That is such an odd phenomenon to me. That's just, wow. I've actually ran into a guy who had that ability, and I call it an ability, I guess, because not a lot of people can do it, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, he was walking around the barracks sleepwalking all the time. It was scary.
Yeah, that could be scary because you don't know where you're going to walk into.
Exactly. You might go to the Army and get an M16, and they're coming, you know, start
shooting.
Or
you just, like, walk into the river.
or that, you harm himself. That's true. It's interesting we're talking about this life after death stuff. Just 8 or 9 years ago, I was a big believer in out-of-body experiences. And I actually ordered, my mom ordered a set of books from Time Life Books called Mysteries of the Unknown. And there's a huge volume of stuff about aliens and UFOs, out-of-body experiences in heaven and the afterlife and just all these various things. And I believed all of it. There was just no critical analysis of it at all. And they knew they were playing to the crowd, the people who already believe this stuff.
Of course they are. I mean, the whole point of something like Time Life Books is to sell books that'll sell.
Right, right.
That'll be entertaining to people. It's not going to be a scholarly publication or a journal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's interesting. You don't see a lot of... scholarly discussion of things like near-death experiences. You do see occasionally, and I talked about them.
Right.
One good book that I referenced in the article I mentioned was Mark Fox.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called Religion, Spirituality, and the Near-Death Experience, which is the exact title. And that's pretty scholarly, because the guy is actually kind of sympathetic to the idea of near-death experiences, and yet he admits sort of the evidence doesn't really go as far as the people who sort of advocate near-death experiences would like it to.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in the book, for example, he even suggests ways in which, you know, this could be sort of, like, corroborating evidence if people had shared experiences. But at the same time, he says the evidence that we have to date isn't like that.
Right.
Yeah.
A question in the chat room says, well, what about those people who claim to have past lives and stuff like that? That's a kind of immortality, I guess, in a way.
That would be evidence for reincarnation, presumably.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
There are a couple things that could explain that. One is... people could be lying, first of all, depending on the circumstances. A more sort of common, normal explanation would be something called cryptomnesia, like amnesia, but with crypto in front of it. That's basically the idea of you pick up information from TV to radio, reading a book, but you don't remember where you got it from. You just know, I've heard this somewhere. And information like that might not be conscious to you anymore, but you go under hypnosis and someone asks you leading questions and you craft this whole story about how life was and 15th century or something like that. And it's based on that information you already learned.
That's
but
interesting.
You just don't remember it consciously because it was filmed like 10 years ago or something.
Huh, this might be related to deja vu probably too in some way. Possibly,
yeah. I think deja vu is probably more like a sort of biological trigger.
Really?
But I wouldn't be surprised if, yeah,
some
I mean,
cases
all the experiences ultimately are biologically triggered, but...
Right.
Obviously, with something like deja vu, something is unusual is happening. It's sort of an altered state, I guess you'd call it.
Okay. Yeah, someone is adding to what you said earlier about the out-of-body experiences. He says that is a chemical reaction. You can get the same effect from various drugs such as nitrous oxide.
Right.
He says dextromethorphan, ketamine, and PCP. Mushrooms also give a unique out-of-body sensation.
Yeah, ketamine is really famous for that.
Really?
Yeah, it's called Special K on the street.
Special K?
it's famous. It's known as the out-of-body experience drug, so...
Does your body mimic some of those drugs?
Well, it's where you have different varying reactions, and this is kind of typical of... they've actually found this by stimulating an area of the brain, you can get something that's just like with the drugs. But people have all kinds of body distortions. They'll feel like their arms are really long or they're really short or something. And one of them is that you feel like you detach from your body. So it's sort of like just one part of a range of possible weird experiences you can have. So.
Hmm. Okay.
So it's not really that unusual. It's just that we all latch onto this because it has this prospect for being, oh, you know, I'm surviving death.
Right. Well,
the other ones aren't as interesting as that one, you know, when that's the question at issue.
Right.
The other thing I didn't really talk about was this other paper I wrote, Hallucinatory Near-Death Experiences. I sort of started that. I was revising the case against immortality.
Okay.
And I wanted to add an appendix to it because I was like, oh, let me look into this near-death thing because no one ever hears about it. And people like Susan Blackmore have written theories of here's how the near-death experience works, you know, endorphins cause disinhibition in the cortex and stuff like that. Disinhibition would be like one neuron stops preventing the other neurons from firing, so they all sort of start firing. You know, they're sort of like control neurons.
Mm-hmm.
So she gave this big biological theory, and you know, it's questionable whether or not it's accurate because it's a biological theory. You can only sort of test it here and there. So when I wrote Hallucinatory Near-Death Experiences, my goal was sort of to, you know, let's look at what the experiences themselves say. And what happened is I found so many cases that if I had made this an appendix to the case against immortality, it would actually have been longer. The appendix would have been longer than the article itself. So I just decided to make it my own sort of a separate article and just on the near-death experiences. And what I wanted to point out there were the cases no one hears about. So it doesn't matter what the biological mechanism is for, but... You know, I already knew this because Blackmore had mentioned it before, but if someone says they're on the other side and they see someone who's still alive there, there's a little discrepancy there as far as reality testing is concerned, you know.
Right.
You know, this guy's at the bank withdrawing money and he's in the afterlife at the same time. And it's like, no, maybe what you think you're seeing is not really the afterlife. I mean, when you get cases like that, there obviously shouldn't be living people on the other side, so then it becomes more like this is sort of like a dream. And basically what it is, I just found a whole bunch of cases like that. One of the books I referenced was by Peter Fenwick, who actually believes in the sort of survival interpretation. And a lot of the cases he gave were examples like that. One of them I quoted was, I believe it was a grenade went off, or it might have been a bomb went off near some people. And this guy was next to two people, and they all sort of ducked when the plane was coming overhead. And when the bomb, he said he like left his body and saw this light. And then when he looked down on his body, he just saw himself. But then when he woke to, there was, like, the guy who was next to him was all blown to bits all over his back.
Oh, wow.
So, obviously, what he was seeing when he was out of his body wasn't what was really happening.
Ah, right.
So that's a discrepancy. He sees his back. He doesn't see this guy all over his back. He wakes up, you know, returns to consciousness. And what he saw wasn't... It didn't match what, you know, if that was really him leaving his body and looking down at the environment. So, you know, there are discrepancies between what's really going on and what you see, which sort of comes to the sort of your brain creates this sort of dream, what it would expect for you to see.
That's right. Makes sense to me. Now, in the chat room, people are asking about the possible benefits of believing. Have there been any studies that show that people who believe in the afterlife are healthier, live longer, and the
second
part
is
are they dangerous?
Specific belief. You know, you hear that about prayer. You know,
right.
The people who believe in prayer or people who are religious more generally are healthier.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be, you know, first to admit that it's possible that, you know, there's some health advantage to believing in something that's comforting.
Right, right.
I think the real issue is whether it's true or not. So it's, you know, it's possible. I don't think there are any studies specifically about that.
Kind of like the invisible friend that someone's child might have.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a view of the world where everything's sort of peachy,
yeah.
Of course you're going to be healthier than someone who's sort of pessimistic.
That's a very good point.
I mean, you know, it makes sense anyway.
Right. Well, what about the dangers then? Are there any dangers of a group of people or people having a belief in an afterlife? What can go wrong?
Sure. I think when you have basically sort of a fundamentalist belief in a certain type of afterlife, then you really have problems. Obviously, if you think that you have sort of duties to God and that you're going to get to heaven by doing certain things, then you start flying planes into buildings. So, I mean, obviously there's a danger there.
And
a lot of people will persecute Jews, for example, in the name of God, thinking that they'll get, you know, sort of brownie points on the other side.
Yeah,
there's definitely a danger when you're basically motivating people on a subject for which there's really no evidence that, you know, there's this afterlife and you'll be rewarded if you do X, Y, or Z. In the absence of evidence, then people just make things up.
Right.
You know, anyone can say anything, and if it convinces somebody, it could be dangerous. Yeah.
Some have argued, what would be the motivation for individuals to plan long-term goals for their families and the world if they really believe that the world is going to end soon or something, and they're going to go to this glorious afterlife?
Right. That's actually an actual problem. A lot of conservatives who are sort of enthralled by this Left Behind series actually don't care about the environment or, you know, polluting the environment. You know, go ahead, keep dumping all your stuff into the ocean. The Earth's only going to be here for another 20 years or so.
Wow.
That's an amazing attitude to take. That's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't take care of the environment, I guess we will all go extinct, you know.
It'll be slow
and painfully, probably.
I brought that up once to someone. I said, can't you see that they're making it happen? And someone said, doesn't matter. It's still prophecy still being fulfilled. It doesn't matter if they're trying to make it happen, but they still keep throwing God in the mix, though. If God didn't want it to happen, he wouldn't let it happen. That's the mentality I hear from a lot of people who support that kind of thinking.
Yeah, I think that whole mentality is supported by this world is so horrible and sin-infested that anything's better than this world. That they're trying to rush, or, you know, as soon as possible, I want to get the hell out of this world.
So, in effect, actually hindering then the, not utopia, but a better society that we could possibly have.
So that's a negative consequence of afterlife belief, is that you don't really care that much about what happens to your body in this life, so you don't mind if you smoke or something like that, you know, even individually. Because you expect, you know, this is just a little prelude or a preface to your real life.
Right.
Especially if it's eternal life, you know. What's 50 to 100 years compared to infinity?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, in a sense, devalues this life because this life doesn't really matter. It's just a test to get into the other life, which is what everyone really wants.
Exactly. And that reminds me of a quote I once heard, and I think I've heard it so many times in many different war movies, and also when I was in the military. Kill them all and let God sort them out.
Oh, yeah, that's a great slogan, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
It just shows the compassion.
Right, doesn't it? Yeah.
I think a philosopher, I think it might have been Miguel, actually said that he thought that belief in Christian or otherwise in the afterlife made it easier for military planners to just sort of decimate entire cities with, like, the nuclear bomb. Because, you know, it's like, well, everyone's going somewhere anyway. So it's not that big of a deal if we kill millions of people in one shot.
Yes.
Like, so that's a scary thought.
And here's a quick, interesting story related to what we're talking about. I was I used to work security for a private company here in Atlanta. And my supervisor, his job was basically make sure that his officers get to the proper posts with the proper equipment, and make sure that if they're armed with an armed client, that officer has the credentials and all those various things it needs by the state to be authorized to carry a weapon. Well, anyway, this guy posted me at a bank, no weapon. I qualified as a master shooter, but my paperwork didn't come back from the state. So and I complained about it, but I let it go. And then one of the workers at the bank informed me that particular strip that I was on was called Bank Robber Alley. that every season, every bank gets hit where the street that I was on. And I said, okay, I think this is the last straw. And I thought that my paperwork was going to come in. It just never did. So I told the guy, look, I can't do this anymore. First of all, you're lying to the client, number one. That's wrong. They think that I'm armed because I wore a jacket because it was pretty cold, cold during the season, so they couldn't tell. So they thought I had a weapon, but I didn't. So I said, you're lying to the client. You're getting more money off the client because they expect to have armed officers, and you're risking my life and the life of people I'm supposed to protect. I can't do this anymore. Do you know what this guy said?
What?
He said, well, God will take you when God's going to take you.
That's one way to hasten someone's death.
Right. And people like that all the time. I had friends like that growing up. Who said, well, you know, God will take you when God's going to take you. Why worry about it? Just have fun. I was like, but you really do control your destiny to a point. I mean, I can...
Yeah, to a point.
If I want to run naked down the street in a crack house and call everybody names, I mean, I'm asking for it. I mean, so... But I couldn't believe he said that. I looked at him and I said, you know what? I'm sorry, but I don't believe in God anyway. He said, well, whatever. That's your problem. I said, well, tell you what. I quit. And I left. I said, this is ridiculous. And unfortunately, no one else will take my calls. They didn't want to listen. His superiors didn't want to listen to me. They all were in on it. And
yes, he was putting other people in his position,
right.
Not himself.
Exactly.
That was probably a rationalization so that, you know, absolve yourself of any responsibility if anything happens to your guys, you know.
Right. So, but the funny thing is...
God's will.
Right, but that's what...
I had nothing to do with it.
Right.
I put him in harm's way, but...
Right.
No, I didn't really have anything to do with it.
Right, because God would take care of him.
I knew it was Bank Robber Alley, and I put you there, but it's not my fault.
Yeah, and at first I thought maybe he just says this to people because he knows that, you know, in Atlanta a lot of blacks are just very religious. Maybe this is just an excuse he says for convenience, but I think he really believes it. Obviously, by his response when I said I don't believe in God, you know, his reaction was shocked.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. A lot of people just get set in their ways.
Chaos Lord in the chat room says, if people really believe in the afterlife, then why go to the doctor? I mean, don't those people want to get to paradise as quick as possible?
Yeah, I've always wondered about that myself. There's a similar thing with the prayer studies. People, you know, if prayer is such an effective treatment, as everyone says, then what's the point of medicine? Why do you even bother to use it? Why do you use that heathen medicine when you can just pray?
Exactly.
Of course, prayer is the last resort when no medicine will work. It's like, well,
right.
I'm so desperate, I'll try even something as cockamamie as prayer, you know? No one says that. No one says it that explicitly, but, I mean, that's implicit practically. It's the last thing you're going to try.
Yeah. I actually had someone I was interviewing for a co-host position here with me, and we were talking about the afterlife, and she says that no medicine works, that no doctors can cure anyone. And I said, what are you talking about? I mean, so you mean tell me that if you have a bacterial infection and they give you some type of illin, whatever, penicillin, one of those cillin derivatives, and it wipes out your bacteria, they did nothing? No. I was like, where are you getting this rationale from? She believed that God is the one responsible, that God is the one who takes and gives, period. No matter what efforts human beings make, it's up to God, ultimately.
Well, I would have pointed to statistical evidence to back up that penicillin works.
I couldn't...
Apparently no possible evidence can lodge that opinion, so...
I don't get it. I mean, but this is the kind of thinking, as you talk...
There's one sense in which that's true, and that's there's no medicine that will keep you alive forever.
Right, right.
You're going to die no matter what.
Exactly, right.
That's about the only sense in which that's true.
And that's just scary. Again, yeah. Again, I guess plenty of examples of when people believe these things, they not only can put, you know, your life at risk, but also theirs and
other people. Look at policy, how public policy is set. Mm. Look at stem cell research and things like that.
Yeah, that's right. Oh boy. Again, yep. Gotta sort them out. Don't worry about it. Last days are coming, ladies and gentlemen. Get ready. Hey, feel free to call in, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, the lines are now open. 888-503-0802. If I missed your question in the chat room, feel free. Go ahead and call in. I'll be monitoring the phone lines. We have Keith Augustine on the show with us talking about the concept of immortality. Have you missed anything? I'm trying to think. I've been asking tons of questions. What else you got for us, Keith?
Oh, well, yeah. Some of the other topics I wanted to talk about, I did sort of go over the main argument, which was mind-brain dependence.
Mm-hmm.
Some other arguments that they're not as strong as that, but in conjunction with that are pretty interesting arguments. Actually, there's an argument that goes back to a Chinese philosopher named Wang Chung, which is basically that it's sort of a lack of evidence argument. This is just one I'm going to go off the top of my hand, but He says that, you know, he's talking about ghost sightings, so this is sort of related. He says, if this is a paraphrase, of course.
Okay.
If there are ghosts everywhere and the ghosts are really apparitions of the dead, then why do you see one or two when you go out on walks, you know, in your whole lifetime?
Oh,
if you see any,
wow.
There should be
right.
one at every doorstep.
That's right.
And the point is that, like, for every human being alive today, there's something like 14 dead human
right,
beings,
right.
right? Because the population, obviously, everyone who's alive becomes dead, and the population of the dead is, you know, more than 10 times the population.
Wait
of
a minute. So basically, you're telling me then is that John Edwards should just go crazy then. I mean, he should have...
Right. He shouldn't be able to get through with anybody. They ought to be crowding him in the room, you know? He should be able to hear with all the voices talking at the same time. So,
wow.
Yeah, if you go back, you know, far enough in human history, and of course, that's just human beings, you know? If you're going to extend the afterlife to sort of like proto-humans and stuff like that, it's going to become a highly populated place. But the sort of argument is that, you know, if there really is this afterlife and there are going to be like 120 million people in it, you know, compared to the, or I'm sorry, 120 billion people in it compared
right,
to, say,
right.
the 6 billion on Earth now.
Mm.
Like, let's say there's 6 billion people now, but, you know, none of the 120 billion people can really leave any evidence that they're here.
Mm.
You know, it's kind of hard to believe. So,
it's interesting.
It's sort of a demographic lack of evidence argument there.
I've never, it's amazing sometimes how the simplest arguments are really some of the most powerful. I've never really thought of it that way, is that, yeah, we should see tons and tons of just ghosts walking around if they really exist, or at least the people who claim they can see them. I'm sure someone would try to rebut that by saying, well, only certain people who are special can see these ghosts, and that's why.
Or only certain, you know, dead people are left behind and everyone else goes to heaven or hell or whatever.
But the funny thing is, they can't say that because the rapture hasn't happened yet for those Christians anyway.
Right.
Technically,
right.
Yeah. I think according to the Bible, they're supposed to wait until the rapture.
Well, some people probably believe ghosts are like stuck between this side and the other side or something, and most of them make it on the other side. But, you know, even if that's true, you'd still expect the numbers to be more
right.
than, you know, the few sightings people have.
Especially considering how many people die every day. So, yeah.
I mean, think about it. You know, how long have you been alive? About like 30 years, you know?
Right.
When you were born, you were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, there were millions of dead people who could have sort of let you know that they exist in that whole time. And not just people that you know who died,
right.
who haven't tried to contact you, but,
right.
you know, your great-grandmother could have told you or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
She still exists.
I'm Wing Chun.
You don't hear from anybody.
Exactly. Like, I'm Wing Chun, and I have returned. We have somebody who just called in. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, I just want to ask the guest, so what he thinks about, you know, some of the things that people claim they can do with, like, meditation, you know, like the monks.
I mean, and... Okay, and... I'm sorry, and how does that relate to immortality, or...?
Well, I mean, as in taking control of their mind, you know, they can...
Oh, you mean, like, biofeedback?
Huh?
Do you mean, like, biofeedback? You know, you
right,
can control your pulse or something like that by meditating?
Well, you know, I'm skeptical of it, but I've seen where, you know, they can, you know, it's on TV, of course, but they can raise their body temperature.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
I'm not really that skeptical of that. I mean, unless it's some extraordinary and possible number, like you can
right.
raise your body temperature to 110 or something like that and
right.
still live. but, yeah, you can control your pulse and things. That's well known. That's called biofeedback.
Right.
I don't think there's anything really...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like huge number differences, but you can control, you can lower by doing certain practices. But it's not really any different than like controlling your arm to move it. You just learn to control like a different aspect of your
right.
body. So
see, this is my problem with that. You know, since the caller brought it up, but I don't even want to try it because I understand autonomic things pretty well.
Yeah,
and it's like it's programmed
well,
no,
it's to not
going to
interfere with. It's not going to stop your heart.
No. I'm thinking, what if I have a hiccup or something? You know, like, okay, I just want to stop it for 2 seconds. Oh, I can't kick. It won't start again, you know, then I'm in trouble. I don't know.
Like blinking, right? Don't think about it because then you won't be able to stop.
Exactly, right? Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. Cause
there are people who can control their blood pressure, but I mean, that doesn't surprise me. You can pick up things, too. You know, you're controlling a
mm-hmm.
part of your body. So,
well, I guess
it's
we
when
can...
you tell me you can levitate mm-hmm. just by thinking about it.
Exactly.
Imagine the amount of money we could save and
right.
get rid of airports and everything.
And I guess we can tie that back into what we're talking about, like especially the soul, because when people can do these feats, which are seemingly, you know, almost impossible with their bodies, people think there's some kind of, quote, spiritual thing happening, that somehow the spirit can manipulate the physical. And
yeah,
have
but it is always an act of desperation when you take that interpretation, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because comparatively, it's the sorts of feats that people can actually accomplish with their minds aren't, you know, as great as the sort of miracle mongers would say they are. You don't have people, you know, for example, like the prayer studies, you know, well, maybe prayer got rid of something that could have gone to remission on its own, but mm-hmm. you never see an amputee grow an arm because that wouldn't happen naturally. Right? That would be an example of something that's really... If that did happen,
yeah.
maybe you'd believe in miracles. But.
I believe in something. I don't know, something's powerful out there doing, making things happen. No doubt about it. Someone in the chat room says about the ghost again. He says, isn't it funny that all the ghosts have clothes on?
Yeah, that's actually, the guy I mentioned before, Wang Chung, actually made that point. Like, going back to, people have made that point in the 20th century and all, but it's great that you can get a guy about, like, you know, 50 BC or so.
Wow.
Saying something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, they should all appear nude, you know, because they were born that
way. That's right. And also, in the movie, they're always walking, you know, like on the ground too, but yet they can walk through walls. Like, what's to keep them from falling through the floor?
They can, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
they go up. It's because it's all controlled by will, of course, and it's sort of completely magical fairy tale
world. Exactly.
Where things are solid when they should be.
But I want,
basically, it's a mirror of the physical world, but you can do a couple of different things.
Yeah, I once asked someone, so wait a minute, if they can, because, you know, a lot of these times on these, like, Fox specials, you see ghosts opening closets and cabinets and bamming things around. So wait a minute, they can affect the physical. So they must be partly physical themselves, then they should be affected by gravity. But if they can go through the ground, then maybe that's where all the ghosts and souls are. They're in hell. They're in the earth. They're in the center of the earth.
Yeah, that's the whole catch-22 of the whole ghost thing.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
There's a great cartoon that Dan Dennett put in Consciousness Explained. It's like Casper's coming outside of a building that's collapsing on him.
Oh.
And at the same time, this towel's falling off a rep, and he grabs it. It's like, wait, how did he go through the wall of the building simultaneously and pick something up physical?
Right. That's why you got to love Hollywood, you know, because I think Ghost tried to actually try to explain that you can will it if you want it. But, oh well. And we got a caller just called in. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Firefold. My question is, how do Christians reconcile the idea that if they go to heaven, and let's say that they're married to somebody who doesn't believe, they're going to go to heaven, and that person who doesn't believe somehow is going to go to hell, and yet somehow, some way, they're going to be perfectly happy, you know, even though their loved one is in hell burning for creation.
Hey, yeah, that's one of my questions about God, actually, on my questions about God.
Actually, that question's occurred to me before, too. I can't imagine
man.
You're up in heaven and you're looking down and you're like, oh, you know, this guy's, my husband is going through torment right now, that you could possibly be in bliss knowing that. So, you know, the only solution could be that, like, God just erases your memory of your earthly life or something like that.
And then, doesn't that defeat the whole purpose of judgment?
Yeah, I would think so.
We got another caller. Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, this is Yogmace on the channel.
How you doing?
And there's a lot of people are talking about what would happen if we were uploaded into a computer or something like that. Like, is that considered immortality? And it's a topic I've been interested in for, a year or two now when somebody introduced the idea to me. And I think that we think we'd be uploaded to the computer and just be able to continue living the way we are, but what would stop the computer from choosing what parts of us to
take away,
leave in and leave out? Like, if people uploaded into it, wouldn't we all just merge together into one collective mind?
Well, your programmer would have to...
You'll be put in a separate folder.
Not to do that, basically.
Exactly, in a different
folder. I'm open to the idea that could happen in the far future. I mean, I don't think it would happen now, but it still wouldn't quite be immortality because at some point, you know, the universe will be incapable of producing any work. It'll just be like this residual heat energy. And so you could live a hell of a lot longer than you do now. But, you know, hardware will wear down. You could just say, well, it'll get copied to something else. The earth will be extinguished when the sun sort of blows up, or bloats up, I should say. So you'd have to be moving from solar system to solar system. But eventually, you know, there's not going to be any usable energy. So it wouldn't really truly be immortality. I think it's just a fact of the physical world, entropy. That immortality is really even impossible in principle, you know, because of the laws of physics. Yeah, you can really, really long time, but in theory, in principle, but not in practice. Everything decays.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, if you have any questions in the chat room, please make sure you type out your entire question, because there's actually a little bit of delay, so you have to make sure you let us know what the context is, because there's 2 minutes delay on the audio feed and 30 to 40 seconds on the video, so make sure you let us know exactly what the context is. Again, that number, we have 4 minutes left here to the top of the hour and the end of the program, 888-503-0802. Question from No Gods. What does Keith think about Ian Stevenson's so-called evidence for reincarnation? We kind of talked about reincarnation enough, but are you aware? Do you know a guy named Ian Stevenson or Ian?
Children who remember previous lives, supposedly. Well, they're different. Ian Stevens has published a lot of things, so you can only sort of talk a little bit about his work. I don't know, you know, it's so in depth that I can tell you everything about his work, but I do know that his sort of initial work was, I guess you could say, what's the word for it? Corrupted. I can't think of a better term. By the fact that he had researchers go out and ask people. Children would say that they remembered, and presumably, or most of the time, happened in India. Or related countries like Sri Lanka, would say that if they remembered being somebody else who died in some certain town or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what would happen is there'd be collusion between the parents, the two different parents, the parents of the deceased person and the parents of, say, the kid who's claiming to be, you know, the reincarnation of someone else. They would have talked to each other before anyone from Stevens' team got there. So there's like this sort of corruption, or I don't know, influence, where, you know, there's no, you're not keeping people apart, information can flow freely, so there's that possibility that kids were repeating what they were either coached or unconsciously picked up.
Ah, right.
So that's one explanation. The other is that, you know, it is kind of weird that these would predominantly happen in places like India and Sri Lanka, where people believe in reincarnation,
sort
of
right.
cultural belief. And
that's
in the
a
US,
good
they
point.
Don't.
That's a, you're right. There aren't too many, like, my son didn't walk into the office the other day and say, "Hey, you know, Dad, I think I was a king once in Africa." You know, I mean, it just doesn't happen. You know, you're right.
There are people in the U.S. who say that. I'm sure Stevenson's claimed to found it. But the point is that they're predominantly in this part of the world
of
where
course.
People believe in reincarnation,
right.
which suggests that, you know, socialization is explaining
right.
why people are reporting it here and not there. And
right,
you know,
right.
someone like Stevenson would say, well, that's the reason they don't report it, is because they're socialized not to believe in reincarnation here. But
right.
I don't know if I'd buy that. Kids, when you're a kid, you're not really that socialized.
Right. That's a
right?
good, very
so
good point.
So you would be reporting
right.
weird memories you have, wouldn't you? I mean, basically right. the sorts of cases he brings up in India are like kids start wanting to get, you know, go to the store and get liquor. Wouldn't the same thing be happening here, whether you thought it was a reincarnation memory or not, that they would have these traits of this dead person?
Right.
So.
Someone says, we talk about the soul here. So, yeah, if the soul is immaterial, what keeps the soul in the body? That's a question I've always had, too. I mean, I say that if there is, in some way, the soul is manipulating the body in any way, it should be measurable at least to a degree. We should be able to say, oh, there's something that's leaving the body there. Here, our instruments is picking up something, but it disappears into nothing. We can't figure
right.
out what that is. We don't get that.
Yeah, to be completely honest with you, if you ask me that if you want to have a really coherent and workable theory of the soul, it has to be in some sense a physical thing.
Right.
Like helium is something that can leave the body, right?
Right.
It's
right.
still a physical thing.
Yeah.
If it's non-physical, what does that mean? Well, Descartes defined physical things as things that are extended in space and time. There are not really many other possible definitions of physical out there. So if you say something is non-physical, that means you're basically saying it's not something that's three-dimensional in space and time.
Mm-hmm.
It might be like a mathematical point or something, but that's an abstraction. And, you know, how does it relate to something that is physical in space and time? Like in a sense, you know, the soul wouldn't be inside the head because it's not in space to begin with.
Right, right.
And obviously our minds are in time.
Exactly.
Because we can think in time.
Yeah.
In correspondence with our body. So I think the whole, it's a sort of erroneous notion. It's sort of like saying, you know, is Windows within space and time? Well, if it's on a computer, it is.
Right.
In that sense, it is.
Hmm.
Right.
Let's take this last call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Augment again.
Hey.
And I don't know, what I was talking about before with the computer is just that in real life, when we're, you know, we're stuck in our bodies and we have to communicate with languages that we've come up with ourselves, because, like, we can all think in our head in, you know, pictures or however each different person thinks, but you always have to convert it to a language to talk to somebody else.
Right.
And I was just thinking, if two people were in a computer and didn't have that language barrier, they can kind of communicate with pure thought to each other. There wouldn't be any misinterpretations, and eventually they'd kind of settle somewhere in the middle on every single debate that they had and just form this new third entity.
Yeah, actually, that sounds quite plausible to me. Okay, I wouldn't deny that. You'd be like this Borg collective consciousness, I suppose.
Right.
If you've got that intimate a connection between more than one mind.
Yeah.
Which also kind of counts against the idea that the mind is this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because how could you merge two different things into one thing?
Well, right now we're separated very physically. Like, you can't connect my brain to somebody else's the way they are now, but maybe if they were pure data, there would be an easier way to do it.
But, I don't know. It sounds like I was, like, mixing two programs. I don't know.
Yeah, it's sort of a good analogy, I think. I mean, people have complained about the analogy of minds being like programs, and for good reason, John Searle mostly. And he has good reasons for that. But I think, like, in a sort of broader way, not the specific things that Searle was worried about, like, he was talking about, like, computer programs as they are today. They only run on syntax, not semantics. They know the relationships between words, like, you know, numbers.
Right.
They can do math very well because they're just all about relationships, one number to another. But they can't understand the meaning of words, that they're about things and stuff like that. I grant all that, but I think the idea of software versus hardware is a good analogy for the mind-body relationship. The mind really is something that runs on the brain.
Mm-hmm. All right, is that it, Yagma?
Yeah.
All right, thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Lastly, I was thinking about this whole, I mean, there are just so many difficulties about the idea of something floating around anyway that you can't see, checking you out.
it's psychologically uncomfortable.
Yes. I mean, I know people who have had to shaken the faith simply because of that idea that grandma is watching them when they try to, you know, masturbate or something else. Or if you really believe that there's this afterlife, and if you believe in ghosts and spirits, and that these things are looking at you, and God is the biggest of all the spirits, checking you out all the time. Oh, that is just very uncomfortable. I think people have to have some type of compartmentalization to be able to...
Yeah, I think they do, too, because if something's looking at you, it's sort of in your environment.
Right.
Right? And that means it can interact with you. So,
which they believe.
You think about it. Come on. All kinds of crimes, horrible crimes happen to people, and spirits don't stop the criminals. Right?
Right.
You know for sure that someone who was, like, close to you who died would try to protect you if they could.
Right.
So that's actually another sort of lack of evidence argument that Guy Wang Chung came up with. So, you know, it's interesting that you can go back in history and find arguments that you'd find today.
Now, one would think that, and this is important, we cover this before we leave tonight, we hear quite often that those people who fear God are better people because they know that when they die, they're going to be judged. Where does the evidence lie?
Well, that's a good question because it's exactly an empirical question. And you just have to look at the behavior of people who do and don't believe and see if it's really any different. And, you know, in general, you'll get sort of like basically no difference. You know, people can be just moral, immoral. And basically what you have is that people will behave badly if they're so inclined, and people who will behave goodly will do so if they're so inclined as well. I think Steven Weinberg said this great thing. It's like, good people would still be good in the world without God, and bad people would be bad, but it takes religion to make good people bad.
Wow.
Something you could put on like a t-shirt or something. But it's true. That basically, the difference is that people will offer different kinds of rationalizations for their behavior. Someone who says there's no afterlife... I might say, well, I don't have to worry about, I'm not going to be punished after death, so that's one rationalization. On the other hand, you can say, I'm going to blow up this building because that's what God wants me to do, and it'll get me 72 virgins. So people who are inclined to be violent towards other people are obviously going to do that, and their beliefs will change their rationalizations for why they do it, but they're still going to behave that way.
That's true.
So what I would say is that good people or bad people really doesn't have any relationship to your beliefs.
That's a very good point.
In the ultimate final analysis.
Right, that's a very good point, because we do see quite often that we see it on the news every week where someone does something horrible and they manage to somehow justify their beliefs using their own theology or theological ideas. In Atlanta here, we had this guy who shot a couple of cops in a courtroom and ran off and wound up holding this woman hostage in her house, and he believed that she was an angel because of his beliefs, but didn't stop him from killing all those cops prior.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's like, come on. I mean, and everybody was all up in arms about this thing, and wow, and she converted him on the spot. No, he was already a believer. But they just don't want to look at that aspect, that his beliefs did nothing to help save those officers he killed.
Some of the Enlightenment philosophers actually sort of elaborated on the point, and they would say, you know, the main reason that people sort of assume that if you don't believe in an afterlife, you know, you're going to be bad is because hell is a deterrent to keep you good, and that if you don't have that deterrent, you're not going to be good, which is false, you know.
Right.
But people assume that, so it goes with the mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And with some of these Enlightenment sort of radicals, I guess you'd call them, they weren't really that radical. They were just thinking people who went against the grain. some of these people like Holbach and Helvetius and people like Diderot would say things like, and basically the idea of hell is too far away, and people's temptations are right here and right now. And in reality, no one's like, people do what they're inclined to do because they're not really threatened by something that might happen to them 50 years from now.
It's funny you say that. That's always my argument. I was just talking to a guy on the phone about that today, is that God's punishments take too dang long. That's the problem. If someone were to steal an apple and lightning comes out of the sky and they just disappear, more than likely, it might work a little better. I mean, you know, nothing's guaranteed, but more than likely, if you see people just blow the hell up from doing something they shouldn't be doing that's not biblical, maybe then
yeah,
people...
There's a parallel argument, actually, about the death penalty that works along that line, that, you know, the death penalty doesn't really deter people who are inclined to murder other people, because these are people who might get killed, and if they're robbing a house and they intend to murder the people inside, they might be killed while they're doing that.
Right.
While they're running from the police, they might be killed. So if the immediate threat of death doesn't really deter them, what makes you think the threat of being electrocuted in a chair 15 years from now?
Exactly.
So it's the same sort of argument, it's just a different context.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, God, if you're listening tonight, there you go. You got to make your punishments happen. A little more snappy there, genius. Come on, you got to do it. Okay, I'm just kidding. All right, Keith, did we cover everything? If you want to go on a little further, if we missed anything, feel free.
Well, we could go on, but we'd probably go on forever, so it's up to you.
No, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Okay, let's see. Some of the other things I wanted to talk about, well, we talked a little bit about the evidence. Basically, the idea that death, I think, as annihilation or ceasing to exist, I think it's really, this is part of the motivation for why people don't want to accept that, is this idea that it's permanent and forever.
Right.
And I think that's the main threat of it. It's that you're, you know, basically what that means is that death destroys you. And so, like, does anyone like the idea of being destroyed? I mean, it's one thing to lose everything you have, but it's another thing to lose yourself, you know what I mean? So in a sense, death is like the ultimate deprivation of your life. It's not just a deprivation of things you have. And there have been, interestingly, you know, throughout the literature, historically, throughout history, different responses to that. And Epicurus gives one of the, and Lucretius gives some of the more optimistic ones, which you mentioned before, that, you know, if you're dead, you're not going to feel anything. And as I sort of pointed out before, my own opinion on that is that, of course, that's true, but that's not what people fear. And I think that's the sort of main sort of criticism of the Epicurean argument. I think there's truth in that. I think, you know, the good thing, one, I think it's commendable that Epicurus and Lucretius tried to alleviate this fear. They tried to alleviate what they thought were irrational fears. One of them was fear of hell, but also the fear of ceasing to exist. And they tried. I don't think they necessarily succeeded 100%, but some of what they said was true. And we sort of talked a little bit about this before, but I'd say at least this much is true, that Epicurus got right, and Lucretius and other Epicureans, and that was ceasing to exist is not as bad a fate. It's not the worst thing that can happen to you. It might be something bad. I think that to the extent that your life is good, your death is bad. Right. So if you're enjoying life, then death is bad. But then you think of things like euthanasia and assisted suicide.
Right.
The extent that your life is no longer good, actually death becomes preferable to continuing to live. So in that sense, I do think that, you know, Epicurus caught on something, that there are worse fates than death. And, like, for example, burning forever in hell would be worse than just not existing anymore. Right? I think that's an obvious thing. So in that sense, he did sort of alleviate part of the fear of death and pointing that out. But that corollary, that to the extent that life is good, death is bad, I think that all else being held equal, if you could continue to go on, you know, and you could just, you know, sort of assure that your life wouldn't be too terribly bad, most people would almost certainly say go for it, you know. They'd want to keep on existing. And I think the main resistance is that to the idea that we don't is basically that sort of desire, you know, to keep on existing. People don't just want to cease to exist unless they're already in like such horrible pain that living is not worth it anymore.
Right. That's right. Right. So what do you think? If we could in some way extend life then to the point where death isn't really a major concern or immediate concern, and also pain and suffering, if in the future we could do this, do you think that those religions that have an afterlife as a major tenet of their belief, would those beliefs begin to collapse, you think?
I think they would, actually. I think Bertrand Russell said something like, I think the belief in immortality never would have arisen were it not for death or fear of death. it's true, actually. I think that not all religions really, you know, have the afterlife center in their religion,
right.
But
right.
A Christianity certainly does. You know, the whole point of the resurrection is to relieve the sting of death.
Right.
And you see a lot of stuff in the Old Testament that, actually, the Old Testament, the early Judaic thought was actually explicitly said that death was the end. You look at like Ecclesiastes and Job, they say things like, oh, everything is vanity and meaningless, and because we have the same fate as the animals, you know, we go down and we don't ever come back up out of the grave again. And he's like really explicit that there is no afterlife, and yet sort of before Christianity came around, Zoroastrian and other ideas sort of filtered into Judaism, and they sort of adopted this afterlife idea because it's obviously more popular than denying it.
Right, <So. laughs> of course, yeah. Alan in the chat room says, some philosophers such as Strawson still accept a form of dualism. Does your guest have any thoughts of why dualism is still accepted by some philosophers? I'm not quite sure. I don't know who Strawson is. I don't know if he's a secular.
Yeah, I do know a little bit about Strawson, so I know what he's talking about. Strawson's view is something like called dual aspect theory sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot like Chalmers' view, which is called property dualism. Basically, that's just saying that, look, human beings have, they're not purely physical. There's some aspect of them that isn't physical. But it's not as far, you know, that sounds kind of, that's not as extreme as it sounds even. Basically, it just says that there are mental things, and mental things aren't physical things. But like someone like Chalmers would say, they're still properties of your brain. So like, it's not something that could exist separately from your body. And Strawson would say the same thing. That's not really dualism in the extreme sense.
Right.
It's sort of like compared to the main idea of dualism, it's not really that different. It's closer to materialism, really. It's just sort of like a real quick qualification to materialism. Everything is almost physical except this thing, you know, certain mental traits, or even all mental traits have this aspect to them that they're not like, thinking that 2 + 2 = 4 isn't the same thing as like having mass or something like that. That's just a real abstract point. It doesn't say anything about like the idea of an immaterial thing going on when the physical thing dies. So I think Strawson's definitely in that category.
It's funny. I hear these gross miscategorizations all the time when I'm talking to people about what's physical and what's not, what's immaterial, what's material. And of course, I mean, in my view, all things are material. I mean, in my view, and all things are physical in my view. But yeah, I see what you're saying. But some people are trying to say, well, yeah, but mental concepts aren't physical in that, you know, they don't exist external to only you. And
I would say that even if the statement all things, everything that exists physical is false, even if that's false, the truth is very close to that. So that, you know, it might be the case that people like Strawson and Chalmers say that, you know, thinking 2 + 2 = 4 is not the same sort of thing as saying that a person is 6 foot tall, right? Or saying that a person is in a bad mood is not the same sort of thing as saying that they weigh a certain amount, right? That would be like a physical, non-physical distinction. But you're just talking about properties of something. It's still a physical thing.
Understood.
That might have non-physical properties.
Right, right.
You're not saying that there's like these two parts to a person and one's completely different from the other. It's just a different kind of property something can have. So it's really not that radical of a thesis.
And that's so interesting because, as you know, afterlife believers, that's exactly what they see as far as you know, the mind-body dualism here is that even though we pretty much have a good idea that the mind is created by the brain, they seem to think that, well, no, the spirit dictates all those things, and round and round we go.
Yeah, there are some Christians who think that there is no soul, but they bring in the idea of resurrection, that when you die, you do cease to exist, and then all appearances to the contrary, God will in the future bring you back, you know, from the dust.
Oh, my gosh.
Even more incredible, in my view, than the idea that there's a soul. I think
wow.
the idea that there's a soul is a hell of a lot more plausible than that this decayed body, which has turned to dust or been absorbed into other animals or something like that, or burned in the funeral pyre, is going to come back to life. You know, that's just incredibly hard to believe. I mean, more than any other miracle I've ever heard. Like, you really don't expect someone to believe that. You know?
That's pretty wild. Yeah. That's pretty wild. Yeah,
idea is that, yes, your brain does, you know, you do need to have a brain to have a mind, but God will recreate your brain. I mean,
right.
Okay, that's putting a lot of faith on the hope that God will recreate your brain.
You know, earlier we were talking about burial and how it relates to death and stuff like that. And immediately I'm reminded, of course, of my own mortality, because that's what we're talking about here. But cremation comes to mind. In my immediate family history, cremation has been our form of basically holding on to our remains. We don't believe in a burial. Now, I've actually been criticized by people, mostly Christians, who think burial is how you're supposed to go, that cremation is evil, or is of the fire of the devil, whatever, you shouldn't do it. God wants you to be buried so that he can resurrect you. If you're nothing but a bunch of...
I think that's actually a very Catholic idea, too.
Ah, okay.
Because of that very thought that, you know, God won't be able to resurrect you.
Right.
It's like, it doesn't really make much difference how you go.
That's true, whether you're ash in a box.
20,000 years from now,
yeah.
If you turn to ashes sooner rather than later, you still turn to ashes.
Wow, I didn't think about that. I can imagine how teed off the Catholics were then about that guy here in, I think, in a small town here in Georgia who was putting ashes of any ashes. Oh, my gosh, in people's urns. Oh, man, yeah, bits and pieces of other people. But, you know, to me, I was like, yeah, okay.
Just got sloppy and lazy.
Exactly. And me, I was sitting here thinking, you know, I can understand why a religious person, you know, I would get upset even as a, you know, as a person who doesn't believe in the afterlife. You know, it's just the principle of it all. But darn.
Yeah, that whole idea really didn't pick up outside. You know, there were free religions like Zoroastrianism that had the idea of resurrection and all.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't really pick up in, say, the Greco-Roman world. You know, the idea of a soul really has a hell of a lot more universal appeal than this really hard-to-believe idea that, you know, your body's going to be, you know, basically even though it's decayed completely down to its atomic molecular components or scattered all over the place, God's going to bring them all together or something, or even create a replica of you from new atoms or something like that.
Right.
That's very hard to believe. I mean, come on, we don't see miracles like that today or ever, you know. So.
Yeah, I'm still waiting to see one like that. But, yeah, I was imagining you were talking about, you know, yeah, just bringing all these atoms back together. That is just amazing. Like, when you scatter ashes out at sea, for instance. I mean, wow. I mean, I guess this is my limited imagination. I mean, I can see it kind of, but that's just crazy. God is going to bring every single one of those molecules. Now, what if the molecules here's a philosophical kicker. What if those molecules now belong to some other animal?
Right.
Yeah.
You just came up with an idea for the next Terminator. Remember the guy that's made of liquid metal, and he would, like, freeze them into little different parts, and they would all sort of, like, seep back together.
Right.
Yeah, I can just see, like, people be walking down the street, and people, like, metal will be streaming out of them.
Exactly.
Because it's been absorbed into other organisms.
See? Look at that. Oh, wow. See? That's amazing. Yep. Again, that's just...
I had to plug that to them.
Yep. That's just something people don't think about, right? You know, yep, dead body at sea, whatever. Sharks eat them, and then Jesus comes back. Poor shark. All those, all that stuff.
Yeah, they were really worried about cannibalism because of that, because you have to resurrect everybody. What do you do with shared parts, right?
Oh, wow. But in some ways, I guess we're all kind of...
The other thing is that, you know, your matter is being recycled all the time anyway.
Right, exactly.
So there's really a lot of matter around that you were made out of.
Right.
That just got recycled into the environment while you were still alive. So
exactly.
You know, the matter that decays when you die is just like your most recent matter. Most of your matter is out there already.
Right.
So, you know, you could create a theory where God could create like 30 or 300 or 4,000 versions of you.
That's a very good point. Wow, that's right. I can see this. Yeah, the rabbit hole definitely gets deeper on this thought. That's right. Everything that is you eventually gets recycled in some way. Some organism, probably my neighbors might be eating a part of me right now for all I know. Who knows?
You're scaring them now.
Eat of my flesh. Well, Keith, thanks a lot for appearing on the program tonight. I had a great time.
Sure.
and we definitely got to get, you recommended that someone else can probably come on a program to talk about the history of
belief in an afterlife. Yeah, that's a hell of a lot more comprehensive. I was just basically talking about the history of disbelief, so you can imagine that's a lot, not nearly as popular a notion as afterlife, and there are lots of different concepts of the afterlife. Alan Segal wrote a history of the afterlife in Western religions. Even that's limited to Western religions. But even that is a lot. That's very comprehensive. So he might be a good guest if you can get him.
Okay. Well, for my Christian listeners, what if you're wrong?
What if I'm wrong?
What if you're wrong and there is an afterlife? Of course, it doesn't really address the question which one. But what if you're wrong? Maybe we're so limited in our knowledge about the brain and the way it works and how it animates us. What if there really is a soul?
Well, then I'm wrong. There's nothing more to it, is there?
Right. That's
What if I'm wrong about politics or something like that? Is that going to determine my eternal fate? Like, why would, if there's this all-powerful, all-caring creator of the universe, going to punish me for not knowing what the truth actually was when I wasn't given all the facts or something like that?
Yeah, actually, yes. Calvinists believe that.
I'm not worried about that at all. You know? If I'm wrong, I don't expect any negative consequences from it.
That's right.
Any more than I would for being wrong about other things. Is this guy going to punish me because I don't know how to do calculus?
right. It's all your fault. He gives you the knowledge of calculus at birth. You just don't...
Right, I don't tap into it. I don't have enough faith.
Exactly. Well, all right, we're definitely going to have you back on, and I'll get this process up and tomorrow for you to share, I guess, with people at infidel.org if they're interested. I think this is a pretty good program, and we're in a chat room right now talking about everything. So, thanks again.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I'll see you another time.
All right, bye.
Keith Augustine is on the program tonight talking about the concept of immortality, giving us a little bit of definition of it. And, of course, before the show, Keith actually mentioned that there's many, many, many different concepts of immortality, depending upon, of course, your culture and religion, demographics, all those various things. So we try to hone in on some of the more major ones. That is, when you die, your soul goes somewhere. And if you're a Christian, of course, you believe that you're going to be judged by God, and there you go. But as you heard tonight, there are a lot of things really to consider if this is really the case. And one thing Keith mentioned toward the end of the program when I asked him, what if he's wrong? Another thing as well is that, well, why would a God send you to burn for eternity or refuse to bring you happiness just because you use the brain that God gave you? You use the brain that God gave you to question. You're being honest as well, which is even bigger. I mean, you're being honest with yourself based on the information that you've been provided, not what some religious quack has told you. And you're really looking for answers for yourself. I think that's commendable. I can't even imagine any being of with any semblance of intelligence would just discount that and punish you for thinking. Makes no sense to me. And even if a God like that did exist, who would punish me just because I'm being honest, I wouldn't want to worship him. And I'll tell him that right to his face. Oh, I guess I just did. This is the Infidel Guy, and I'll see you all another time. Thanks for listening and watching in reason.
Ie Jesus Domine, dona eis requiem. Ie Jesus Domine.